No individual.
No exemptions.
No individual.
House Committee on Revenue for February 27, 2009 will come to order. We have scheduled four public hearings this morning, and we're going to open all of them together. So open a public hearing on House Bill 2077, 2078, 2649, and 2651. Chris.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In your packet, you have a one-page summary table that hits some of the highlights of the policies contained in the four bills. So I'll just briefly walk through each one of those to describe the gist of what they do. Two of the bills create a 10% bracket. One affects the federal tax subtraction, and one actually creates a kind of alternative minimum tax. All four of these are for personal income tax filers. 2077 reduces the federal tax subtraction to $3,000 for most filers, $1,500 for married filing separately, and takes effect in 2009. And so that would be a reduction in that subtraction from about $5,900 down to $3,000. There is no specific income range that's affected by that. This one affects the largest number of taxpayers because everybody who's under that $3,000 would be affected to some extent or another. Only the highest income taxpayers wouldn't be affected, those who are, excuse me, I think I said that backwards. The first year impact for that is $121 million. 2078 creates a 10% tax rate at $150,000 of income, taxable income for single filers, and $300,000 for joint filers, and raises about $80 million in the first year. This one, the impact here is a little bit different than the way it's drafted. I assume that the $150,000 and $300,000 would be for 2009. The way it's actually drafted, it goes back to the original table, so the indexing would have actually had that start at about $230,000. So it's a slightly different from the way it's actually drafted. 2649, well, actually, let me skip down to 2651. That's the other one that creates another 10% bracket at starting at a little bit lower income level, $125,000 for single and $250,000 for joint, and that raises about $90 million in the first year. The fourth one, 2649, creates a minimum tax for filers with AGI above $125,000 single, $250,000 joint. And that AGI is 7.5%. The minimum tax is 7.5% of AGI. So the calculation there would be you'd kind of have a dual calculation. People would calculate the taxes in the normal fashion after credits and so forth, and then compare that to a calculation of 7.5% of the AGI, and then their tax would be the greater of those two. And this one, I have there $145 million impact for full-year filers. I was getting a $207 million impact for all filers, and the thing that jumped out at me about that is, generally speaking, full-year filers pay on the order of 92% or so of the income tax. And when we make broad changes to the policy, like the 10% rate, that percentage kind of holds up, and the full-year filers will bear about 92% of the tax change. But on this minimum tax, they were bearing about 70% of the tax change. So a disproportionately large share of the tax increase was going to part-year non-resident filers. So in some sense, it has elements of that perfect tax where people out of the state are paying the larger tax. And to give a sense of magnitude, the average tax increase for that one, full-year filers, was about $6,800. And for part-year and non-resident filers, the average tax increase was about $25,000 and $34,000. The reason I only put the $145 million for full-year filers there is because I'm still looking at the modeling of exactly what those impacts are. I haven't convinced myself that those numbers are actually correct. I think there might be something with the way it's being apportioned down. But I just wanted to let you know that depending on the policy that gets implemented, because the way, if you recall the way part-year and non-resident filers get taxed, non-resident filers pay gross tax on their Oregon income, and then their credits and deductions get apportioned to Oregon, and then that's their tax. Part-year filers, we apportion their income and tax that apportioned part. So with a minimum tax, there could be some policy levers around exactly how that minimum tax is calculated, because the AGI here is just their Oregon AGI. So there might be an apportionment thing going on that's affecting those numbers differently. So those are broadly the policies you have here. The two tax rates, you'll get a different effect on taxpayers because that does increase the top marginal tax rate, so you'll get some behavioral effects that are different there in response to the tax. A minimum tax could have some policy implications for the effects of other policy tools, such as credits and so forth, that get used by taxpayers. So there's some overlapping policy discussions you'll want to have in terms of all of the different policies embedded within the personal income tax system. And then the federal tax subtraction affects the broadest number of taxpayers. And so that's kind of the summary that I had.
Thank you. I think maybe we'll go ahead with the hearing unless there are specific questions that anyone has of the way of what these things actually do. Okay. I'm going to take people in order. Ralph Groner, Chris Allman, Jody Weiser.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I really will attempt to be brief. I'm working at that anymore. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I represent American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. Lest one say, oh, well, he's just another public employee union, I finally occurred what I wanted to say the other night, meeting a friend of mine who belongs to a new conservative movement in Oregon. When he explained it to me and told me what their final stand was, which was smaller government. So I want to address that, and I doubt you'll hear many people do this, but I want to do that as quickly as I can. We need revenue, ladies and gentlemen. But quite frankly, we haven't just needed revenue since this recession or the last recession or the one before when I was here or the one before that when I was here. The truth is, since Measure 5 passed, as most of you know, and Measure 4750 passed, as Measures 11 passed, and go on and on. The fact is, this revenue system, so contingent upon the volatile income tax, has in fact not been capable of handling the kinds of things that truly save the taxpayers' money. So that's going to be my point. I'd like to say that we represent, my union does, people who work on the firing line in the world of prevention. So what are those? My people are parole and probation officers who put their lives online to keep people out of the state prisons, or when they come out of the state prison, to make sure they don't go back. My members are the alcohol and drug treatment professionals, are the very people who attempt and are very successful in keeping people out of the state hospital or the state penitentiary. My people are the people who are the caseworkers throughout all of your counties that deal with keeping senior citizens out of the more costly nursing homes. I can go on and on. Quite frankly, when I look at the total public employee system and I see school teachers today having to pay for supplies out of their own pocket in overcrowded classrooms, when I see caseworkers that have been overloaded and handling foster kids and kids are killed, babies are hurt, and child abuse at home, I realize the Oregonian sometimes misses it. What they really haven't done is been able to connect the dots. The dots are that our finance system has been broken and getting more broken all the time. I think that we have attempted to be fiscally responsible on the cheap. Let me make my point. When I have local mental health, for example, that works, and now most of them are being privatized, Cascadia is an example where privatization hasn't worked, and that's all been in the Oregonian three-part series, so I won't cover that. But if we do not have prevention on the firing line, be it in human services, be it in education, or public safety, all three of which I've mentioned, the truth is, being fiscally conservative is not truly what it's been out to be. I would start a new party called the Fiscally Responsible Party, because in my opinion, not my opinion, my studies over the last 40 years, economics in college, community action director, county commissioner, college board chairman at a community, broad range of background, is that the fact is my experience has led me to believe that if we aren't going to be preventative, we're going back to the institutional state, which is much more costly. Some of you are new. What do I mean? We closed Fairview in Salem. And that was the federal government helped you do that. But the truth is that institutional care cost you 4 to 5 times what you're paying today. My members are also Albertina Kerr are my members. We are not just public agencies. We are most of the MRDD private sector, where our members make just a bit above the minimum wage. And the thing that brings Ralph Groner in to where we're on strike in 4 or 5 occasions to be the community organizer is the one that drives me most are the single mothers at MESD, Josephine County, Coos County, the single moms working another job at Burger King on the weekend and in the nights another job. And if we're pro-family, we have to understand that we cannot allow this 100% turnover in this industry and single moms who are out working so that they can somehow afford health on their family at the home. That is not family value, nor is that good preventative care in terms of our budget. I believe that we'll end up more institutionalized because my friend told me what, I said, what do you support? He said, police. You will have police without ARP members and SEIU members and OEA members, and if I missed a union, AFT members on the firing line, ladies and gentlemen, because you will see the state hospital grow to the point without our members that will cost you 5 times more. You will see a new Fairview will cost you 5 times more. You will see nursing homes cost 4 to 5 times more than home health care. You will see a return to a much more costly institutional state and government. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair Barnhart. My name is Chris Allman, and I'm a grassroots activist. I come from the Have More class, and I'm here on behalf of working Oregonians. I'm here because I recognize, just as was mentioned, that in society, if we don't support our wage earners with a sufficient enough salary and safety nets, that we are going to have a society where we have prisons overcrowded, and that will be how we create jobs in the future. I'm here today with my son, who's in public schools, and a student from France who's observing America in his last day of a 3-week visit. And I want to tell you about my experience 2 evenings ago. Our family is a Jewish family. I'm not Jewish, but I respect all the world's religions for their values. And the woman that I heard speaking was a woman named Gerda Klein. Gerda Klein was a survivor of the Holocaust. Gerda Klein, her story has been documented, and she has won, and her story has won an Academy Award and an Emmy. And when I hear what is bantered around about shared sacrifices, and I hear her story, I need to share it with you, because her story is one of where she survived and where part of her survival, where the shared sacrifice that helped her survive was a raspberry, a dusty, dirty raspberry that a friend of hers gave. And this friend died a month before liberation. She died. And in that regard, this woman who looks at America as her salvation and is proud of this country for its freedom, made me humbled, because this woman knows that this is a country that can do so much more. My husband is a radiologist. My husband makes a lot of money. I was a primary care physician. I left the field a little over 10 years ago and became an activist. It started in my means of advocating for my child because I realized I wasn't making a whole lot of money anyhow. It was making our lives complicated. Healthcare was becoming draconian. It's far more draconian. And it wasn't really making a difference one way or the other for our family because my husband made so much money. So we have this situation where providers like radiologists that are fee-for-service are paid so much more. Now, I can't change that. But what I can do is suggest to you that we don't need this much money, that we want a society where my kids can grow up and feel that there will be jobs, that there will be economic justice, that we won't have a society that's chaotic and out of control and the only out is putting everyone in prisons. This needs to change, and we, our family, can give much more. I struggle every day because I try to figure out how can I help? How can I help more? And there are times that I want to give up on being an activist and want to just say, okay, it's time. I'm going to go back in with my emeritus license and just work pro bono for all the working poor, growing in numbers. I tried to do that almost 10 years ago. There weren't that many free clinics available. All were mostly dealing with STDs and mental illness, and that's not my forte. I'm an endocrinologist. The care that I must give to a patient like that was being stripped away. 15 minutes maybe I would get. You can't do that and give good care. You can't give care when patients don't get chem strips to check their blood. That's the kind of field that strips away whatever it is my dignity as a primary care doctor was all about. So I'm asking you, we've got the have-mores, the haves, the have-less, and have-nothing. We have a flat income tax, let's face it. We are taxing our poorest, those who are meeting federal poverty guidelines. Senator Chris Telfer, in a hearing on EITC, was saying, this doesn't make sense. She's right. It doesn't make sense. Why are we taxing the very poorest? So what I'm asking you is, I know there's going to be a lot of crunching, a lot of numbers crunching that you need to do, but think about this. Think of who we are as a society, those who do have disposable income, those of us who can share. And there are plenty of us who can and will and want to. But it has to be your will. I hope you don't refer this to the public. We need this money. We need it now because we have to balance a budget. It's time to do it, and I respectfully ask you to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jody?
Good morning, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. It'll come as no surprise to any of you that we support increasing personal income taxes as one of the responses to the growing crisis we're facing. And especially, we support doing it in ways that these four bills represent, because they address issues like this. Oh, I forgot to pass in my testimony. May I get it?
Sure.
Because it has a graph.
You have some written?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it has a graph.
Jody hasn't done this before, so
it's her first time.
It's early for a break.
Well, it's easier if you just pass it when you walk in the door, but it can be complicated for the staff to do that. So you're going to see soon in your hands will be a graph. It's a graph from the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, and it shows Oregon's tax system, how we tax different pieces of our population. The poorest fifth are paying 9.2% in state and local taxes. The wealthiest 5% are paying 6.7%. That is not really a very fair situation, nor does it look at who really has the money and can give some of it up. And like Chris, I happen to be in that top 5%. And when there have been tax increases in the past, it really has not affected my spending, and it hasn't been a huge sacrifice, but it is part of the sacrifice that we all should take part in. The solutions before you today would create fairness and revenue, but in some ways they just nibble at the margins. Bigger opportunity is actually available now. So before I speak directly to those four bills, please allow me to speak more generally.
Please, that's why we're voting all of them at once.
Yeah, that's what I thought. The crisis provides opportunity. Before this economic turndown in the last session, you established the Revenue Restructuring Task Force. And I think you actually thought that you would have some really concrete program ideas that would come out of that. And you did get one. They worked very hard to address what to do about stability. And in fact, that's an enormous problem, and if we'd addressed that problem 4 years ago, we would have an extra $1 billion to spend right now, and our crisis would not be as deep as it is because we wouldn't have passed out the personal kicker. So that's significant, but they didn't come back with any great ideas about how to reform personal income taxes. At a meeting last night of Tax Fairness Oregon, I was asked by the group to bring to you a plan that would cause significant restructuring of our personal income tax system. Three ideas taken together would address fairness and both immediate and long-term needs for adequacy. You could make Oregon the state with the fairest tax system at the state and local level if you increase revenue by over $1 billion by implementing three ideas. The first is the idea that's been on out there for months now from the Republican Party, and that is that we make our tax system less onerous on those amongst us with the least by broadening the width of the 5 and 7% brackets. If we did that, rather than getting to 9% at $15,000 for a family filing jointly, you wouldn't get to 9% unless you had $30,000 of taxable income, which is really about, you know, it probably put you in the $40,000 to $45,000 worth of income range in order to have $30,000 of taxable income, which would put it kind of with about where the middle of our taxpayers live in that income range. The second idea is to remove entirely the subtraction for federal taxes paid. We would not be standing alone. In fact, we would be standing with 35 of the 43 states that have an income tax if we made that change. Most states don't allow a deduction for federal income taxes. So we have a bill that say, let's bring it down. This more radical restructuring would say, let's eliminate that deduction entirely. And the third step would be to have everyone pay the standard deduction. There's a lot of income that gets untaxed because of all the advantages that are there for those of us who itemize. Those advantages don't necessarily serve any broad purpose in society. And if we removed the option of using itemized deductions on our state tax forms, we would join 11 other states that do this. So it's not like these ideas aren't ideas that other states have. And in fact, in that case, we would be joining Connecticut, Illinois, Indiana, Louisiana, Michigan, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and West Virginia. That's a pretty decent group to join. That Oregon's tax brackets start early and reach the top marginal rate quickly is hard on her taxpayers. That we also allow itemized deductions and the deduction for federal income taxes paid serves to imbalance the fairness of our system and sap our adequacy. The revenue gained from this restructuring would probably be in the range of $1.1 billion.
Oh, so this M is wrong.
Yes, it is.
That should be a B.
That should be a B.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's what happens when you go home and write after a meeting.
I was wondering what we were fussing over. Now I understand.
Yeah, that should be a me. So as you can see, these ideas actually come out of the ideas that are in this bill, in these four bills, plus the idea from the Republicans about broadening our brackets. The polling for increased taxes on wealthy suggests that either 2651 or 2078 would prevail with voters. If you were only taxing voters that had income above $1 million, over 82% of voters would think you were doing the right thing. When you drop that down, it gets to be about 60% of voters who favor increasing tax on wealthy. If you go below that, people start going, oh, that's too close to home. And they're not sure it's wealthy. Now, voters aren't as smart tax smart as you are, and so they don't really realize that a family with $250,000 with income probably, taxable income, probably have between $300,000 and $350,000 worth of income. But that's not a piece of education that we're going to be able to do this year. And so I think that using the $250,000 for a family would prevail in the polls and is something that is definitely you should consider, and we would prefer 2651 because it raises an extra $10 million a year and uses a number that Obama and the public are quite used to of $250,000. While we like the 2649 and the alternative minimum tax, we fear that it may have a hard time prevailing in the polls because of the bad reputation that the Port of Design Federal AMT has. So that's a good idea, but we can go farther, and we actually don't come up with the bad PR that we come up with that. And House Bill 2077 would reduce the current $5,600 deduction to federal taxes to $3,000. That's a small step in the right direction, but we can simplify and make our tax system fair while providing far more appeal by reducing taxes and doing away with the deductibility of federal income taxes entirely and having everyone pay their taxes using the same standard deduction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before I take questions from the members, could you give us a reference for your big table on the front?
That's from the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy.
Questions for this panel? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about broadening the tax range, the levels. Mm-hmm. And two of the bills we have add one more level onto the tax at 10%. I looked at that and I said, okay, we have a 5, 7, and a 9, and then we tack on a 10. Why wasn't that 11? Wouldn't that be more reasonable?
It would certainly raise more revenue.
Not 30 is
I actually like 12, 18, but I was moderating.
I think that most states are stopped by the 10.3% in California.
Okay.
That's the highest, and I think that it has created a barrier. New York State is talking about adding 3 steps to their tax system, and they stop at 10.3. Okay. In fact, Oregon has taxed its wealthiest at a higher rate in the past when we were in economic crisis. But we did it by, I believe, if I understand history correctly, which I might not, we did it with a surcharge, so everybody had an increase. If you look at the history that's in Basic Facts, we, back in the first depression, we raised the top rate by 2%. But we actually doubled the bottom rate at the same time. We went from 1% to 2% on the bottom rate at that time. If you took those early numbers and you indexed them, I'm sure you wouldn't get to 2.5 million as the where to implement the top rate. I'm sure it would be a much lower number, but people's sense of need is different now than it was then, I suppose.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jody, the handout that you gave out in the bar chart there is very helpful. I appreciate that. If and as we assume we're going to, so as we move forward with discussions about changing marginal tax rates, another, I wonder if your institution has this, another analysis that would be very helpful to me, to coincide with this. Here we're talking about the share of taxes paid by relative people on the economic scale. I'd like to know what share of Oregon tax receipts are paid by those groups. So, you know, you start with the poorest fifth and you go up to the top 1%. I'd like to know what share of total income tax receipts to Oregon are paid by the poorest fifth all the way up to the top first.
Well,
because I think you'll see a little bit different representation.
You see, absolutely different. Because when you ask for 5% from somebody who makes $100 and 5% of somebody who makes $1,000, and you know, there's going to be different. And that's true in any tax system that that you would have, even if in the flat tax system you're going to have that. And actually we have basically a flat tax system. And the part of the reason this goes down is because of the deductibility of our income tax on federal taxes.
You have that? I've seen that nationally. I just like to see it from an Oregon perspective. I don't know, maybe Jody, maybe not you, but maybe we have that.
Okay. Yeah, it certainly is available.
It's typically published in the Wall Street Journal when they do an editorial on taxation, so it's easy to find.
Yeah.
Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in the chart that you're talking about because it shows what we charge classes, how we tax classes, and we don't actually tax classes. We tax individuals. So I'm not quite sure why that would make a difference, that chart. I think it's an interesting chart.
May I follow, Mr. Chair?
Well, I think that was a question to you.
I'm asking if I can answer it.
Sure, please. Go ahead.
I think it's very important because what we're talking about here with all of these, well, at least with 2078 and 2651, we're going to ask, let's be honest, the most affluent Oregonians to pay more if we were to pass it. And I think it's a fair, whether you're for it, against it, or indifferent and deliberating, I think it's fair to know what portion of those Oregonians, what portion of the taxes we already see that they're paying if we're going to ask them to pay more.
So could I speak to that?
Please.
I think that the thing that we forget is that the wealthy of us can avoid many of the costs that economic downturn has. When my academically oriented son went through school and we were having a recession, he did not go to classes of 40 kids. He went to private school. So the turndown really wasn't affecting my nearest and dearest the way it is going to affect everybody else's. And yet I do want to live in a society where kids grow up in classes where they can learn. And so I think that that's, you know, I think that the society protects more because they protect me and provide services for me than they do for somebody who's low income, even though that low income person might be getting EITC.
Can I speak to that also?
Please, yes.
I noticed an op-ed column last week that was generated from the Cascade Policy Institute about whether or not you parents would want to send their kids to public schools, suggesting that 9% wouldn't. Well, I'll tell you, under these economic times, when we're hearing about schools that are closing, how can we feel comfortable under these circumstances that our public education is going to serve our kids? That's not the real question. The question is, are you going to make sure there's adequate funding for these essential services? So, you know, yeah, we can send my son to Jesuit if he gets accepted next year. And I'll tell you, I'm hoping he is because I really don't trust our government to come through for us, because this is a matter of adequacy. This is a matter of our future.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Kelsey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that sentiment, and I think that all of us that are Oregonians care about the future of our kids, and I think that all of us that are parents want the best for our children. But I think just in terms of the record and the quality of public schools in the state of Oregon, as a person that's deeply aware of the reductions that we're facing and the hits that our public schools are taking, my confidence in the quality of our school employees in this state and the parents that support those schools is so great that every morning I send my four children off to public schools in a district that's been making reductions every year since 1990, and I'm confident that they are receiving a world-class education, including a child with very significant special needs. So I do think that we have a long ways to go to make that education even better and to make sure that we are doing the best that we can for everyone. But I want to be careful that in the discussions that we have about our needs to improve the services that we have, that we don't unintentionally, and I'm not suggesting that this was intentional, undermine the quality of excellence and the dedication of the public school system and how well it's serving the kids.
I'm talking about school days being, I'm talking about days and
thank you. We could have we could shift it into being the education committee. I would prefer that we stick with the revenue issues, and I recognize that I think the two of you agree on the idea that we need more funds for schools. Representative Bruins.
Oh, I just wanted to follow up. I mean, first of all, I just want to make sure that the committee understands, and I think we all understand, but I think it merits to be said that, you know, we're talking about people, you know, that are make 125 or 150, and as Jody, you well said, it's probably more than that, you know, by the time you get done with deductions. But I also want to say that those people aren't all equal in their life obligations and everything. I mean, let's just make an analogy out of thin air. You've got an empty nest couple living in the Pearl District that have no kids or whatever, and that's one scenario. And you've got an equivalent income scenario that the family may have four kids in college, so it's not the same. Let me just put on the record, I'm all for soaking the rich. I think soaking the rich is a phenomenal, I like, if the top 10% are paying, I don't know what it is, if they're paying 80% of state income taxes now, I like them to pay 90 or 95% of state income taxes. I'm just concerned, Mr. Chair, that the way to soak the rich is not necessarily raising that rate, because you're going to get tax flight, you're going to get tax avoidance, you're going to get all the things that people do to serve their best interest to avoid paying those taxes, including simply investing elsewhere, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. So we can quote you now as being in favor of soaking the rich. Thank you.
Get more from them.
Appreciate that. Representative Call.
Yeah, just to kind of get back to the documents here, so maybe try to focus this a little bit. Jody, I think I'd like to talk just a little bit about the idea of removing the opportunity to deduct federal income tax altogether. I don't know if you have these numbers, and maybe this is actually a question for staff, but I'd like to see at what rate we see the middle class come in and actually start to deduct federal income tax. I think that to my way of thinking, there are some people who should be soaked, and one of the best ways to maybe work some progressivity back into the system is to take away that deduction to a certain extent, but I'd like to make sure that when we're doing that, we do it up until the point where middle class people aren't being denied the opportunity for a deduction that they might sincerely need. So I was wondering if you could speak to that just a tiny bit.
This bill would take us into below the middle class. I seem to have passed that paper away, but it. If you look at what the average household income is and you try to figure out, well, you know, when would they start paying $3,000, if you really wanted to not hit the middle class, you'd probably have to raise that to $4,000. But I'm suggesting that if you raise if you change the brackets, that takes care of that problem. Because you've raised the brackets, you've given them less state taxes to pay, so you don't need to deduct the federal piece. And it just simplifies that whole step.
Can I speak to that, too? I think that there's a lot of problems when we talk about what the middle class is. One of the things that I think is really important is when we talk about living wages, what it is that we need to sufficiently feed, clothe, house, purchase health care, buy our gas, pay our utilities, all those things. And that's, again, where it absolutely shames what our federal poverty guidelines are all about. It's a number that we really need to use as a target, the living wage.
I have those numbers.
I'd appreciate
those. And I'll get
those.
Them for you.
Thank you, Joe.
That would be very helpful. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Let me just say I'm intrigued by the suggestions that you've made, and I may pursue a little bit where those take us. I have had difficulty with the idea of increasing the width of the brackets because of the effect on the high income end. But these other changes that you're proposing take care of that problem, and at the same time make the tax at the top end a bit more progressive so that Representative Bruin's sentiment can be carried out.
I would save a little bit by changing the brackets.
Yes.
But I'd be paying taxes on about $45,000 more a year than I'm currently paying, which is about, you know, the average household income
right.
in the state.
One final comment while you're still sitting there. I am convinced that people of wealth receive a great deal more because of adequate and appropriate public services and safety nets and adequate wages for people at the low income end, because they have so much more in the first place. The increase in security, adequacy of education for other people's children, and a whole variety of other things are far more important for the wealthy than I think even the wealthy themselves, for the most part, understand. And it is worth it to them to pay more because they have more in order to make those things happen. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. John Millen and Mike Leachman. Mr. Charles, Dr. Charles, did you want to be heard today? No. Thank you. Oh, yes, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen, co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. Human Services Coalition has about 80 members statewide. We've been working since the early 1980s, taking action on basic human needs in the state of Oregon. Mr. Chair, before I begin, I just would say that some of the discussion in this committee has been among the best that I've heard in the building, far-ranging in many instances, and appreciate the fact that how quickly the discussion about revenue lends itself to the use of that revenue. And
that's the point of it, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
So why would we have taxes if we weren't going to spend it on good things?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Going back a number of years, the Human Services Coalition had tax principles long before many groups talked about them, and it's not rocket science, I think, to talk about things like stability, fairness, and adequacy, but those are the things that we always come back to as the Human Services Coalition to see how changes in the tax structure might affect people. Obviously, we're concerned always about low-income people and what they pay, and also at the other end about the services that can be made available for low-income people to help them live a life of independence and dignity. We've testified a number of different times at the Task Force for Revenue Restructuring and talked about our concerns about both about our principles but also about hoping for some bold solutions to come forth from the Task Force. There were, of course, a number of good discussions, a number of good recommendations. But we find ourselves, of course, month by month in a situation where revenue is declining, the economy is suffering mightily. And so I know that President Courtney has said this, but others have said this, is we can't simply cut our way out of this particular problem that we face. A number of you heard us come before, we went before virtually all of the Ways and Means subcommittees as a budget coalition, and you'll hear Lori talk about the budget coalition in a moment. But basically, education, human services, public safety folks, we got together and said we wanted to talk to the budget writers and to say basically that we were very concerned about the balancing of the 07-09 budget. And I recognize that train has left the station. Ways and Means is going to vote on it today. But basically, part of our message was also getting us to 09-11 and the challenges that we face there. And so that's why we're very pleased about the discussion that's going on here today. And we have taken a look at the various bills that you have before you today, and we are supportive of the intents of House Bill 2651 and 2078. The higher tax rate makes sense for us. Again, it's a matter of those people who can pay being able to provide that revenue that's needed. We also support 2077. That also meets a test of progressivity as far as income tax is concerned. We haven't yet taken a position on House Bill 2649, although we're intrigued by the idea of looking at an alternative minimum tax. We simply haven't had a chance to discuss this, and we'd be interested to learn more. Basically, we just want to underscore the concept, the idea that we want to be able to do the best that we can to get to 09-11 with a way that is balanced as far as revenue discussions are concerned. I just would mention something in passing in ending my comments is that the last panel was particularly instructive. I always get a pleasure out of hearing Ralph Groner testify. Way back in the early 1980s, I worked in Clackamas County when Ralph was county commissioner. We went through some very difficult changes during the recession. But also in recognizing Representative Call, distant relative Governor Attia, was part of a solution that really worked for all of us back then. As a new worker to county government at that time, when I had the surtax to pay, I didn't find it onerous at all. And yet what these bills are talking about are far better, in my opinion, because it's looking at people being able to pay that, people paying that at higher income levels, where the surtax was simply put on everybody, where you get to the 9% level very quickly in the state of Oregon. So basically, just in closing out, just would say that we're very pleased, the Human Services Coalition is very pleased to be working with the Revenue Coalition to talk about how we can go from here to the 09-11 session, to the 09-11 biennium, with a plan that is going to work for Oregonians, and we're, of course, particularly concerned about those that are most vulnerable. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Mike Leachman. I'm with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I want to speak briefly about the bills before you, and also have in mind, I know that you'll be seeing some other similar bills. Representative Riley, I know that there is a bill being drafted that would create a new 11% bracket.
Yeah.
And these bills are right to seek a tax increase targeted at the wealthy in this recessionary time. You know, as Nobel economist Joe Stiglitz and others have said, given the choice between cutting public spending and raising taxes in a targeted way on the wealthy, the better choice for getting out of the recession is to choose the targeted tax increases. The wealthy will save some of the income, would have saved some of the income that they would be providing in additional taxes, whereas the public spending cuts that you'd be making is money that would have been going out and getting into the economy. So it's if you choose cutting public services over a targeted tax increase on the wealthy, you're choosing to make the recession worse.
I'm sorry, would you say that again?
Sure.
Either I heard it backwards or you said it backwards. I'm not sure which.
Okay. So the point is that if you have a choice between reducing public spending or raising taxes in a targeted way for the wealthy, that the better choice during a recession is to raise taxes in a targeted way on the on the wealthy, because they're going to take some of the money that they're giving in taxes out of their savings. That's money that would have been out of the economy, and so you're choosing, instead of cutting public spending, which would have all by and large be spent right here in Oregon, get out the door, get spent, be moving in the economy, you're choosing instead to take money, that some of which would have been outside of the economy.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
And I don't mean to, your testimony is excellent. I don't want to cut it. I just want to make sure for the committee's benefit that we understand the difference between high income and wealth and that they're not always the same thing.
Right.
Income is a cash flow measure. Wealth is a balance sheet measure. And because somebody has high income, doesn't, and that's what we're talking about here with these bills, we're taxing income, not wealth. I just want to make sure we understand the difference. Wealth is the difference between is what's left over after you subtract your liabilities from your assets, and high income is just what your paycheck says. And somebody who has that those four kids in college or whatever the scenario may be, even if their income is really high, doesn't necessarily make them wealthy. So.
Thank you, Representative Bruin.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bruin, thank you for that clarification. I think that's an important point. Unfortunately, the income tax is the primary way that we that we do this, and there is a correlation, of course, between wealth and
Mr. Chair,
high
income. There's other ways to look at wealth. I mean, our current tax system looks at income; it doesn't look at wealth. But,
correct.
But that's something I think we should have on the table.
So
and be
you,
talking about.
You would suggest to
I'm not.
You would suggest
necessarily no. I just want to make sure that
a property tax.
Well, we do that with capital gains and estate taxes and everything else. But what I'm talking about, Mr. Chair, is just making sure that we understand what when we're not talking about wealth necessarily. Could be somebody has a high income. Certainly could is more likely to have wealth than somebody who doesn't have high income. But there is a distinct difference between income, high income, and wealth. And I don't want to confuse the issue because this is an important topic, and it's very serious this session. And so I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page. And we're all on the same, you know, we're using accurate definitions when we're discussing this. And I truly didn't mean to cut off your testimony.
I very much appreciate the clarification. I think it's an important one. The difference between cash flowing and money held. And those are very, very different things. And you got perilously close to proposing a property tax on
we strike that from the record.
Thank you.
In addition, as others have mentioned, we have an opportunity to improve our tax system for the long term. We've talked about how our overall state and local tax system in Oregon is upside down. It's not based on ability to pay. And in an environment in which inequality has been increasing over the last generation, and when the economy grows, and it will eventually grow again, if it follows the what's happened over the last three periods of economic growth, the benefits have not been flowing very well to low and middle income families. So especially in that environment, it makes sense to have a system that is a tax system that's progressive, not regressive like the one that we have now. I also wanted to mention that we had, and Jody alluded to this, we've had brackets, a top bracket higher than the current 9% bracket for significant part of our history. For 30 years, in fact, from the mid-50s through the mid-80s, we had a top bracket that was higher than the current 9% top bracket. Now, the income level at which that top bracket kicked in shifted a lot over those years. In 1986, the top 10% bracket that year kicked in today's dollars, at about $19,000. For joint filers. Also, I wanted to share with you and the handout that you, one-page handout that you have with you speaks to this, a preliminary analysis that we've done looking at the effective income tax rate for in Oregon for millionaires and for the average taxpayer in Oregon. It shows that, and it looks at it over time. So as the chart shows, that in 1980, the average effective Oregon income tax rate on income greater than for those with incomes over $1 million was 9.1% in 2006, based on our, again, preliminary analysis. That's down to 7.7%, so it's declined over that period for the wealthiest or for the highest income households, and as opposed to 1980, the average for all returns, the effective tax rate has actually increased. finally, I just wanted to mention quickly the federal subtraction. Only six states have the federal subtraction, and the rationale, in our opinion, doesn't really make sense. We have rationalized the federal subtraction as because it's been argued that it's not fair that we tax money that's being taxed at the federal level. But, you know, this is the sort of thing that happens a lot in our tax system where we use the same where two different taxing bodies use the same basis for determining what's fair to tax you. In our property tax system, for example, cities and counties use the assessed value of your property in determining what is a fair amount for you to pay. The same thing is happening here. The federal government and the state government are both using your income tax to determine that's the basis for deciding what your tax should be. That in itself isn't unfair. What matters is how much tax do you pay, and the federal subtraction has a greater benefit for those higher up, relatively higher up the income scale. In fact, only less than a quarter of the poorest fifth of Oregonians get any benefit at all from the federal subtraction. So we would also be interested in an approach that would eliminate the federal subtraction combined with a restructuring of the income tax brackets, and you can offset some of the you can improve the system generally also by improving the earned income credit at the same time. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing Oregon Education Association and its 48,000 members. I am also the chair of the Oregon Revenue Coalition and the newly emerged Oregon Budget Coalition that you saw around the building in the last week. Here to talk a little bit more about the policy aspects of tax policy rather than the logistics pieces that others have addressed so well. The Oregon Revenue Coalition began in the 2001 session and now includes at least 50 members and organizations. And our guiding principles, we hope, will be your guiding principles as you work to consider a way to deliver fair, adequate, and stable revenues for the state on both the corporate and personal income tax side. And we applaud your thoughtful and fair approach to looking at these questions. We think that the system in Oregon's income tax structure, poverty tax structure, and otherwise has been broken for a very long time, and downturns such as the one we're experiencing now only exacerbate that fact. So this is a golden opportunity, given that the public is very much becoming aware of what's going on, to take a look at how to improve the system for all. We also have in our guiding principles the sense that, as it's often said, when you're in a hole, stop digging is the first principle. We would hope that you will, as you proceed forward with this committee, resist the temptation to make the gap even wider by expanding, extending, or creating new tax expenditures to add to the 358 already on the books, however otherwise worthy, unless you have some way to neutralize their revenue impact to the state, because we simply can't tolerate the hole getting any larger. As you've heard from very many others who believe that public investments, not spending, have not only important and enormous public value, but also have a stimulus effect on our economy and will help us grow out of this recession. While I'm not here to particularly endorse any personal corporate income tax proposal at this time, I would say to you that we want to make sure that whatever it is that emerges from this session has the public support. And we all know what Oregon's system yields in terms of the ability for referrals or referendums on revenue policy. And so we want to make sure that fairness is a part of the concept, balancing the load for those who have the most ability to step forward is certainly a theme you've heard this morning, and we think Oregonians share that view. And to that point, I've
given you something that we've just recently prepared that maps for you the 63 successful property tax increase proposals that passed in 26 of Oregon's 36 counties right during the middle of what Oregonians were experiencing as a recession in November 2008. They have shown you that despite the fact that they were foregoing meals out and driving to work instead of taking the bus and taking the family to the local movie theater and so on in order to economize in their own households in this recession, they were willing to say yes to taxing themselves for those services that they value most. As I said, in 26 of Oregon's 36 counties, those are urban, rural, and suburban, rich and poor alike, and I find that remarkable. In that same election, you may note that they also turned down the opportunity to cut their taxes with respect to the federal deductibility, and they also improved our double majority law, and according to the opponents of that ballot measure, made it easier to do this kind of tax vote in the future. I think that tells you all you need to know about the circumstances of the public. They, even in times of their own difficulty with their family budgets, believe in the vital services that the state provides and want to make sure that our schools stay the excellent school system that it is, that our public services in general are adequately supported so that they can help Oregonians, because they see taxes as two sides of a coin. They see services and they see the money to support those services as equally important values for their household. And so it's not an either-or circumstance. And in our research, we've discovered that how dollars are spent is as important as how many they pay.
Thank you very much. Questions or thoughts for this panel? Yes, Representative Springer, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this question's for you, Lori, as I look at this document here, and it's a great map. And you said there were 66 successful bonds or levies.
63. That's on the second page. I've itemized them for you.
Okay. And I looked through that second page, and I saw all the bonds and levies that had passed. And so my question stems from my personal experience in my district. I have five school districts that I represent, and I know two of those had bond levies for their schools, and they both failed. So this document would be even more helpful for me if it also showed the bonds and levies that failed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, that's a great idea. I think we'll add another page to show what the percentage is of them all. I know that for the school portion of it, 5 out of 6 local options passed, and I think about 42% of the school district bond levies passed.
Okay. And that's follow-up?
Yes, please.
And so that's a document or at least some facts that you can get me?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that would be beneficial for the whole committee.
Okay.
Representative Call?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment to John and to Lori, since you brought up Governor Attia, just an interesting conversation he and I had this summer when I was running. He very fortuitously saw this economic recession coming. And we were sitting in a Chinese food restaurant right across the street from his office in downtown, and he said to me that he thought the greatest obstacle to us being able to do the things that they were able to do in the 80s wasn't the will of this body, but rather that he felt that there was a real distrust of government in the electorate and outside of this building, and that he thought the big difference was that when he and the Democratic House and Senate took a surcharge to the voters, they believed that the money would be spent wisely. They believed that it would actually sunset, and had faith in their government to be able to do for them. And that was really an interesting conversation, and it really kind of digs into what Lori was talking about trying to test the will of the vote, trying to test what the voters are going to be willing to do. And I think that it's, you know, oftentimes the unspoken policy that really drives the entire discussion here is how do we get at that problem. So I really appreciate the fact that you both kind of commented on that, and I thought I would share that with you. And then lastly, I'm wondering, this Oregon Center for Public Policy graph is really very useful. I'm wondering, since the income tax system is what we have and what we're going to be working on, and this is kind of following up on Representative Burns' comments, is the mechanism by which we're going to try to effectuate bringing greater progressivity into our system. It's not the most efficient way to get at wealth, as we've seen, I think, pretty clearly articulated and well articulated by the representative. So at some point, raising taxes is not only going to be inefficient at getting at that wealth, but it's also going to be impactful on the economy and potentially have impacts at maybe worsening or prolonging the recession. At some point, that would happen necessarily. And I'm wondering if you know or have a ballpark of what you think an amount of revenue that we could pull from the rich, as Representative Byrne referred to them, that would get us to a point where we could generate significant revenue but not have a detrimental effect on the economy. I'm wondering if there's information like that out there.
And you might comment on the assumption as well.
Indeed.
Yeah, my assumption may be wrong.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Call. There's an interesting paper that I'd be happy to share with you all that I alluded to, that Nobel Prize economist Joe Stiglitz co-wrote earlier this decade when the recession in 2001 struck, where he pointed out that he spoke to this question of what should states do facing this kind of situation. And he made the point I tried to make earlier that, you're choosing a targeted tax increase on the wealthy, that's the best thing to do for getting out of the recession quickly, because what you want to do is you want to get as much spending out there happening. And if you're cutting money that would be spent in the economy by public employees, spent by contractors who would be getting contracts with government, by public assistance recipients, if you're cutting that spending, that's spending that's coming right out of the economy that would have been reverberating out there. And if your alternative is to raise taxes from the wealthy, who don't need to be spending all that money right now, it's some of that money is coming out of their savings. So that's the better thing to do in a recession. So I think that does speak to the assumption implicit in your question that it's you're going to make the recession worse if you choose to emphasize cuts in public services. You know, at some point, of course, if we just raise taxes infinitely and we weren't spending the money in productive ways, then that would be bad for the economy. And raising taxes separate, you know, if you set aside what's happening on the public spending side, raising taxes hurts the economy, no question about it. There is a balance to be found there, but given the current situation that we have, we're faced with this choice of where do we place the emphasis on cuts to public spending or on targeted tax increases, and I think the bulk of the economic evidence is towards focusing on keeping public spending up and targeting the tax increases.
Mr. Chair, if I might just follow up briefly.
Did you want to comment on that piece as well?
And I did.
I think both of them would like to comment on that piece, and then we'll take a follow-up.
Yeah, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would remind you that 2 years ago we brought in Dr. Richard Sims, who made a presentation to the Joint Revenue Committees, and I can make his presentation available to this committee again this year if you'd like. And one of the pieces of his research showed that the 10 highest so-called tax
business-friendly states with the lowest rate of corporate and personal taxes actually had the worst economies, and those, conversely, highest tax states with the so-called least business-friendly environments had actually the most thriving economies. And while the dynamics are complex, there's not a simple argument for that. His presentation clearly showed that there is also not a direct line between low tax and high economic vibrancy. In fact, just the opposite.
We heard from two different economists from very different points of view on that day, and they both reached the same conclusion. Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, a slightly different point. In thinking back to the 1980s, what we did was distinctly Oregonian in nature. We took a look at what we could do around balancing the budget, looking at the sources of revenue that we could come up with. It's really very instructive now thinking about what's happening with our neighbors to the north, where they have a huge budget deficit, but the only way that they go, because they're so heavily invested in consumption taxes, is to look at trying to balance the budget with a revenue source that they have. So one of the things that I think was always a part of that discussion back in the 1980s, and hopefully a discussion that we'll have here in Oregon, is the idea about shared sacrifice and those people that were working and able to contribute to continue to contribute. So I think that there's a distinction there that really, calls to what we did back in the 1980s and what we might now do here for 09-11.
Thank you. Your follow-up, Representative.
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I can push this out of the abstract a tiny bit. I really want to get this clear in my mind. So thank you for your indulgence, and thanks to the committee as well. Right now, I think we spend down our reserves, and we spend all the stimulus money, and we still got $1 billion about to raise out there. Is it your contention that through if we raise taxes on the wealthy, you look at create a 10% tax bracket, and we get $79 million out of that. So is it safe to say that the abstract idea that you're talking about, we can raise $1 billion in new taxes by implementing kind of a radically progressive structure in which we're taxing the wealthiest to accumulate that revenue and push that into the public sector, bolstering all of the public services that we have, that would be the better policy, economically speaking, and would shorten or at least stave off the increase and expansion of the current recession, that is the best policy choice for us? Or I know that I'm oversimplifying things, but I'm trying to pull it out of the abstract against we should be spending, if we have two choices between spending public dollars on public services or raising taxes on the wealthy, we should raise taxes on the wealthy because the economic impact is lessened. I see that. But when we're talking about a 10% increase or creating a 10% tax that gets us, less than 10% of the way towards our budget shortfall, I'm wondering if you think that it's reasonable to expect that we can raise enough revenue to dig ourselves out of this hole and not have an adverse economic impact.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Call. Yeah, I think we would say that we should not try to get $1 billion out of the top 1%.
Okay.
Okay, that we need a somewhat balanced approach. I think there are other sources of revenue, corporations, for example. I think that I think there are ways to talk about getting to $1 billion. I'm talking about the weight of the balance that we're cutting here, and. I wanted to point out that we looked in a report that we released in December at a proposal that would create an 11% bracket on incomes for joint filers over $500,000 and single filers over $250,000. And the taxpayers that would be affected by that tax increase in 2005 and 2006, if we had had that in place, sure. That group of taxpayers... collected in those 2 years combined over $22 billion in income.
That's really the kind of question I was asking.
So
I do want to, so I want to make the first point that I made, but I also want to, it's sometimes hard to believe how much money there is at the top of the income scale after a generation of extraordinary inequality increases.
Can I get a copy of that report?
Yes.
Please.
All of us, please.
Mm-hmm. Thank you as well. This has been very illuminating for me.
Thank you, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr.
I'll get it eventually.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment on the last remark about the sheer volume of wealth. I have a feeling it's a lot less today. I mean, like, a lot. And maybe by about half if we look at the stock market. But that aside, let's assume that we do find a broad enough tax to raise the type of money that we know is going to be necessary. I think Representative Call's remark regarding a distrust of government is probably the most interesting question I could ask you three, and you might share with us what you think creates that distrust and what you think we should do about it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I have had experience at the local level being part of local government, and I think that the trust at the local level is a little higher in surveys. When people see government close to them, they tend to like what they see. And I think that one of the things that I would say that is a good hallmark of what's going on about government that is we need to get the message out better is to use the Department of Human Services as an example where they're going through their transformation initiative, which is basically to look at ways to streamline the bureaucracy, have better customer service, those kinds of things. So I think it's always true, the case is always there, that government can always improve. And I think Americans in general have had a history of having I think a healthy suspicion and skepticism about their government. I think it's one of the things that keeps the discussion vital and keeps everybody on their toes. But having been a public sector employee for most of my career, I can say I saw a lot of the best and brightest in the public sector really working hard. So I think for you, one of the things that I always said when I would talk with advisors and people at the local level and talking about the work that all of you do, I said, most people don't have any idea how hard you work and how dedicated all of you are. And I think that it's easy enough to take pot shots at government, but I think that government also needs to respond by saying, here are the things we think we're doing right and demonstrate that for the public. And I think we don't do that enough to let people know, here's how we're making a success in people's lives. One final thing I will say is in Human Services Subcommittee yesterday, discussion about the temporary assistance for needy families, it wasn't people getting up and saying, here are the program statistics, but it was the people getting up and saying, here's how this program made a difference in my life. And I wish more and more people would have an opportunity to see those kinds of discussions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, committee members, I'd like to echo what John said and say that we have to be careful about our public comments. It's very easy to be critical, to demand more accountability and transparency, for example, and then when we implement it, we don't come back and say, there, we're doing a great job. We implemented these ideas. We are doing what the public said they wanted to ensure that our tax dollars are spent wisely, that public services are being delivered effectively, and that we have great systems. We don't do that part. We do the critical part publicly, but opinion leaders very rarely then go back when something is going well and celebrate that publicly. And so what we end up with is the negative message points on talk radio and so forth. And I think that's really poisoned public dialogue and made people who've never looked at a school budget or a balance, a spreadsheet or what have you, just have this urban myth that 30 cents of all their tax dollar is spent on waste, fraud, and abuse when that's not the fact, or they don't know whether it is or not because they've never actually scrutinized it. They just believe it.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to chime in on this one because this is actually a speech that I've given many times to many groups about why folks think that the government can't be trusted. And while it's true that it's always been a little bit of the public psyche to feel that way, there are two things that I'd like to say. One is I'd like to echo the fact that we ourselves create that myth, because when we're talking to our friends at home, we say things like close enough for government work. And you know, we ourselves know better than that, and we need to stop saying it. The other point is that it really became very prevalent when the person with the biggest bully pulpit in the nation said something like, the 10 most scary words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." President Reagan was probably the biggest cause of the public thinking that the government couldn't be trusted.
And there we have the debate. Others?
Can we all chime in on President Reagan?
That's off the topic. That's what it is.
Let me just say that we are facing what could be a $4 billion shortfall.
Yes.
A $4 billion shortfall. And
yes,
what we decide to do here will determine how successful we're going to be in filling that hole. There's no time for levity. This is a serious matter. And the question is, how do we appropriately identify why people don't like the government? And I would suggest one thing that I hear continually out in my area, which is very poor, and that is that they feel government employees make too much money. And they think that we're going to take this money and these taxes and give it to the government. Now, I would challenge you, when we're talking about taking the money and giving it to the government, to figure out a way to explain it that isn't going to result in a defeat at the polls of whatever we do here. And I do not think it's worth resorting back to old truisms at a moment like this. It's too serious. Now, I know we're all serious people, but it's easy to forget the size of the problem. $4 billion is what I've heard. $4 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at
May I say, I think that's the right number,
I
too.
I think it is the right number, certainly.
Yeah.
So, serious matter. And I know you people are serious. And so, forgive me. It's just that I need a better answer than what I've heard. And I'm not sure that I know what the answer is. And I don't expect, you know, maybe to get it today. But I do appreciate your thinking.
Representative Vince, I appreciate that comment very much. I think it's that it's very important for us to think very carefully about these topics. And part of the reason why I have scheduled several panels this week to talk about various things we could do in terms of taxes, and why we will, and why we opened all of these bills today, was to try to have the beginnings of that general conversation. I think you're absolutely right about the potential shortfall. It is, and that is a very scary number in terms of the kinds of reductions in very basic services that Oregonians need in order to be successful. I also very much appreciate this line of discussion, because just in a general way, we need to know better how to get the word out to the public how successful government has often been in many of the things that it has done, how careful we are in spending the public's money, although certainly the public doesn't always agree on all of our priorities, or certainly not all of the public, and how good enough for government work is really, in Oregon, a very high standard. Although that phrase doesn't mean that. So you're right. Let me make my own comment, though, on this. President Obama gave an amazing speech the other night. And I think, for me, one of the most important things about that speech and about the reaction to the speech was that Americans are coming to understand that this economic crisis we're in is huge. That in order for us to get out of it, the government, and that includes the state of Oregon, is must respond appropriately and well and with as few mistakes as possible, because we collectively, the governments collectively, are the only entity that's large enough to actually do the job. Nobody else can. So we must. Now, Oregon doesn't play a very big piece in that, but we do play a piece. We're 1% of the population and roughly 1% of the gross domestic product and all of those things. And while that's not a big number, we are 1%. And it is absolutely become incumbent on the state legislature in the next couple of months to get this piece right. And so I very much appreciate your comment and the fact that the committee is working hard on this. And, of course, we kid and joke partly because it's either that or not sleep at night, given the crisis that we face. So I appreciate all the discussion we've had today. Did you want to add to something? Thank you. Anything else from the panel? Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on this, on these bills? I don't see anyone. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett representing AARP. I will say I'm going to try to be brief and actually try to follow through on that comment. I think this discussion has been thoughtful, although occasionally amusing, but certainly all the ideas and suggestions that have been put forth today I think are very helpful. I want to commend you, Mr. Chairman, for actually starting this discussion sooner rather than later. I think the reality is whether we're looking at $3 or $3.5 or $4 billion shortfall here, when you actually get into the details of what's required to balance a budget, I don't think there are many of you serving in this legislature who are prepared to make a $1 or $1.5 or $2 billion in budget cuts. And so with that in mind, you're going to have to look at some way to provide some additional revenue. And I, as I indicated to you before, when I was before this committee, I think these are the kind of options that you've been discussing today that you actually need to move forward with. And again, I've indicated that AARP is certainly very, very open to these discussions, and as they move forward, I'm sure that we'll be more actively involved in the discussion. But I just wanted to indicate our willingness to consider these types of proposals and encourage you to continue this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Anyone else? Thank you very much. And I appreciate the conversation today as well. And with that, we'll close the public hearing and adjourn the committee. Yes.
Hey.
Good. How are you doing?
I wanted to just follow up with you. You talked about